Welcome to episode 44 of Rail Talk. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm an ownership advisor at West Point Thoroughbreds, and I don't know what that dance John was doing was, but very impressive winner over the weekend for DJ Stable. One might say a rising star performance from Bullet. And you know what that means? Your boy's going to Royal Ascot. Either that, or I'm going to have to start a grassroots campaign to get me on that plane.
Oh, Jonathan Green, general manager from DJ Stable. Joe, my friend, if only it were so easy. If only it was so easy where you just snap a couple of fingers and the horse would magically appear in Royal Ascot and I'd magically appear in a form-fitting top, hat, and tails, neither of which I think is going to happen. But we can get into that into the show. Welcome, everybody, to show 44.
Rail Talk is sponsored by The Green Group, the number one accounting firm in the horse business. There's one reason that they're at the top of the heap. No other CPA firm knows the horse industry like they do. Len's got over 200 horses with DJ Stable, has won over 2,500 races. Green Group's got close to 1,000 clients in the horse business because they make the money and save them taxes. But you don't have to take it from me. Listen to this satisfied customer who we know quite well. Take it away, Mark.
We use The Green Group for all of our accounting. He's actually doing our son's, I just met with my son this morning, and the Green Group's working on his taxes. Well, what I found with the Green Group is that they approach accounting in a similar way to the way TaylorMade approaches serving our customers in the horse business. They're always looking for a better way, right? And they're looking to minimize your tax burden and communicate thoroughly. And really, because we're not experts in that area, we don't know anything about it. So we rely on them to help us use the tax code to the best of our ability. They're really looking with a goal in mind to reduce your tax liability as opposed to just processing taxes. And I've dealt with people that handled it that way, and this is much different. They live the horse business. Len is very active. John Green's very active. DJ Stable. It's, and when you're in a business, then you naturally can help your clients better than you can if you're just some accountant that's parked somewhere in the middle of America and you've never owned a thoroughbred horse before. You know, you just really can't understand all the nuances to it. So it's just a completely different experience. You're dealing with a group of people who really understand the business you're in, and they're able to help you better as a result.
Thanks for that testimonial, Mark. Here's a special offer for listeners of Rail Talk to get that same level of service that Mark Taylor and the TaylorMade family get. Len's got offering a complimentary, confidential half-hour consultation guaranteeing you'll get value. You can call him up at 732-634-5100 or visit them at greenco.com. Do it soon. He'll prove that he can save you taxes. Unequivocally guarantees he'll find value in savings. Donate to your favorite charity or whatever you want. He's not worried. He's always found value before, and he knows he can do it with you. So what's that number again?
732-634-5100. Green Group, 732-634-5100.
Thank you, Michael Agresta, the unofficial composer of Rail Talk, for that latest excellent jingle.
He is so good.
Hit him up.
He is so good.
he's the man. So hit him up at that number or greenco.com. So we were the only podcast smart enough to release on Wednesday, at which point we're able to talk about the Preakness field as they'll line up on Saturday. And as I'm saying that, I'm expecting the second we hang up from this podcast, there'll be another major scratch. But Muth is out of the Preakness, who was likely to be favored for Bob Baffert. Obviously changes the complexion of the race. He had speed. Mystic Dan is going to be a much shorter price now. It's great that Mystic Dan is showing up at the Preakness. You know, I appreciate Kenny McPeak having the wherewithal and the patience to step back and say, hey, let's see how the horse trains. Apparently he's training well, so we wish him the best of luck, because how cool would it be to have a triple crown on the line at Saratoga at Belmont? Like, that place, and by cool, I mean a bit of a shit show, but also very cool. That would be a blast. I don't know, John, I don't know how you feel, but like the way people were talking about Muth, like you would have thought he was like American Pharaoh or something. There was like, it was as if it was like a foregone conclusion that he was going to win this race. And him scratching out, like, I didn't love him to begin with. I'm kind of interested in the other Baffert horse, honestly, Imagination now on the outside. But yeah, obviously it takes a main contender out of the race. But I don't know, John, does Muth lay over the field that people, the way people are making it seem?
You know, Joe, I think before I answer that question, I have to ask you a question, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
There were a lot of people, and I'm serious when I ask you this, there were a lot of people on Twitter and on Instagram that were saying, oh, the 150th Derby should have an asterisk next to it because Baffert couldn't run in it and Muth would have, you know, laid over the field and blah, 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 blah. Well, you know what? Muth is out of the Preakness. Does that mean there should be a freaking asterisk next to this race also because that horse can't run in this race? I don't, right. I mean, you know, you could say the same thing, I guess, if that's your logic. That's not my logic, but if that's your logic. Anyway, enough of the negativity and the nonsense that goes on in Twitter sphere that I get sucked into sometimes.
Set your timer for when he comes back.
When I come back, it's like Swift Hitter saying he's not going to be on Twitter anymore. And then like exactly. A day later, he shows up, right? Hey, Swifty. Anyway, I think it's going to be a really interesting race. Yeah, it's disappointing that Muth is not running. I'm sincere when I say that because he is a really nice horse. And I would have liked to have seen him run in the race and win, lose, or draw, you know, at least show what he had because he was being pointed for the Preakness race. There's a sneaky horse in here, Joe, that I think that a lot of people are overlooking. I mean, I immediately was drawn to Mystic Dan. I was immediately drawn to Tuscan Gold on the, you know, almost on the far outside. The Chad Brown horse, the Medallia Colt. And you don't see very many Medallia Colts sell for $600,000 anymore. Not the Colts, but he did as a yearling. So he must have been just freaking outstanding looking. A lot of people are also talking about the horse on the way outside, the quote unquote other Baffert horse, Imagination, who also is a really nice horse, never worse than second in six starts. But I really like Catching Freedom in this race. I really think that there's a horse that got into a little bit of traffic problems, ran a really credible race in the Derby, only lost to Sierra Leone in the Risen Star, by like a length and a half. What did I say, Rising Star? See, that's on my brain already. Star. And Joe, he is the only horse, Catching Freedom is the only horse in the entire field that has actually won at this distance, at this goofy distance, a mile and 3/16. He's the only one. He's run well on the slop. He's an improving horse. Almost every single race he's improved upon based on his numbers, he's won at this distance. And I think he's a sneaky horse that, that he's going to be overlooked a little bit because of the excitement of Mystic Dan, rightfully so. And I'm very pleased to see that he's running. Shifting to Mystic Dan, I know Kenny McPeak's initial reaction is, hey, the last time we ran him on 2 weeks, on 2 weeks rest, he didn't, fare very well. But if you really dig deep into those races, it wasn't just so much that he ran twice in 2 weeks. He ran three times in 4 weeks at two different racetracks. And that's a big ask for a very young horse. That was the first three races of his life. He ran a maiden race that he ran second in at Keeneland. Then 2.5 weeks later, they ran him and he won by 7+ lengths, ran a 96 Beyer at Churchill. Then they stepped him up in distance from 5.5 to a mile to 8 furlongs on 2 weeks rest. And he ran kind of a lackluster as the favorite allowance race. But I think that's more of a, hey, that's a big ask for a two-year-old to do that. And now he's a three-year-old. He's a little bit more developed. 7 months can do a lot for a horse between 2 and 3 years old. And I really feel like that I'm hoping that that's the reason why Kenny McPeak finally said, hey, you know what? Maybe this horse does deserve the chance to run in the Preakness. But I'm going to stick with my three horse Catching Freedom. And I'm looking forward to talking to David about his insight about this race as well.
Yeah, my issue with Catching Freedom, and I think this is the most interesting part of Muth scratching, is not necessarily that he was like this huge favorite, most likely winner. I didn't think so. But he does take speed out of the race. It looks like Baffert's other horse, Imagination, is going to clear from the outside. Catching Freedom's got a lot to do in every single race. You know, he shows up, he makes his run, but he's just going to need a lot of help up front. He cuts back a 16th of a mile, shorter stretch. I think it's typically a more speed favoring track. So I respect him and the way he shows up, but I just think he's going to need too much to go his own way. But I will say, with two Dwayne Lucas horses in the race, you got a decent chance of a fast pace. Because Dwayne is not one of these guys that likes to have, like Chad Brown, that likes to have his jockeys stand up in the irons and yank back and look like they're downhill skiing on these horses. He wants this horse to show speed. However, they did send Just Steel in the Derby. That didn't work out too well. He backed up and got a 55 Beyer, was beaten a million lengths, and Seize the Gray, not super fast, but should be close enough. So I think that's, and I'm, like you said, I'm interested to talk to David Aragona about this, about what he sees the pace. turning out to be, because there was a lot of questions about that in the Derby. I think it was a little faster than we anticipated. The other factor and the other interesting storyline here is this will probably be the last Preakness run at Pimlico as a dump.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, they're supposedly going to start the redevelopment of Pimlico this summer. They say that if all goes to plan, the Preakness will still be held at Pimlico in 2025, which would be the 150th running. And then after that, it would be at Laurel in 2026 and back at Pimlico in 2027. So if you're there, you better appreciate those broken bathrooms and that busted infrastructure, because it ain't gonna be your little mom and pop track anymore. In the next couple of years, they're really gonna start to redevelop it and make it into a destination, which I'm really excited for, because you know Pimlico is an American staple, and so is the Preakness. And for it to have just rotted away that way it has for the last several decades is unfortunate. So yeah, I'm honestly a huge fan of this weekend, and I think sometimes the Preakness gets a little overshadowed by the Derby, especially in this era now where it's not guaranteed that a lot of the horses from the Derby will show up. You know, I was watching, we were doing a little podcast for the West Point Partners earlier I was doing it with Jason Blewett and Tom Murphy, and Jason wanted us to pull up some our favorite Preakness memories to show and talk about. And mine was the 2007 Preakness, which was when Curlin wore down Street Sense in like a great stretch duel. And I was just thinking about that and how cool it was that the top three finishers in the Derby came back in the Preakness. And it wasn't like an aberration. It wasn't like, oh my God, I can't believe they're doing this. That was just the norm. And if you remember, Curlin and Hardspun then also showed up in the Belmont and ran great. And it just, you know, I don't want to be like an old fart here and I like overly traditionalist, but we're losing a little bit of something when we inevitably stretch out the Triple Crown, because that to me stamped those horses as great. And obviously Curlin in particular went on to do many more great things to prove his greatness and eventually was elected to the Hall of Fame. But it was just after those three did what they did in that Triple Crown season, I was like, wow, we are in for a treat with these three-year-olds and, you know, potentially four-year-olds going forward. Like it doesn't happen anymore. I was pleasantly surprised to see Catching Freedom coming back in this race on 2 weeks rest. And I think, you know, relatively speaking, this is a pretty strong field, even with Muth out, definitely stronger than last year's field,
right,
which was pretty much an embarrassment. But it's just, I think this might be one of the last Preaknesses that we have that, you know, as we knew it at the old crusty Pimlico 2 weeks after the Derby. I think it's going to be look a lot different in the near future, for better and for worse.
No question about that, Joe. And you know, you bring up some really good points about, is the old girl still going to be, you know, around? Is it going to be a facelift, or is it going to be a complete, reconstruction deal? I remember when Atlantic City was closing and when Garden State Park was closing, a different story, not being, you know, refurbished. And people were coming in on the last day with tool belts, with literally tool belts, with electric, you know, screwdrivers and saws and hammers and crowbars to get a piece of memorabilia. Do you think that's going to happen this weekend with the Preakness? Do you think people are going to start taking some seats home with them?
You see the picture of like some guy walking out with like one of those porta potties on his back.
Well, that happens
that's
anyway.
The biggest landmark at Pimlico as it currently stands is the freaking porta potties in the infield.
I always laugh. I always laugh when they show this on the internet, when guys try to run across like 50 of the porta potties and people just start hammering them with beer.
Full beer, not empty beer cans.
It's just, it always cracks me up. I always have like a race announcer in my head going, and they're off, and he makes it through the first 10 without incident. Oh, he gets hit by a tall boy and he's down and he gets back up. Like it goes through my head when those guys try to do it. And every now and then a guy makes it, and every now and then a guy falls through the ceiling of one of those and comes out blue. It's just
honestly, like Pimlico is the Preakness day of Pimlico than the infield. That's like, not to be morbid, but that's one of those instances, like the running of the bulls, where I'm like, how does like 10 people not die doing this every single year? Like,
exactly.
An extreme sport.
And it seems like it's always the same guy, but it's not. It's just a younger version of him. It's like Stupid Drunk Guy 2.0, Stupid Drunk Guy 3.0. It's like they keep getting rebooted, but they have the same issue with their software.
Exactly. Well, how about the OG, the greatest vintage of those guys was a dude who tried to punch Artax.
Yeah. You know, I just looked that up the other day when I was wondering. It was like on one of the undercard races, and basically he thought he was going to be a matador, right? And try to punch the horse. He stood there and tried that was the weirdest thing ever. And he's like, for a couple of years, he was kind of like famous because of it. And then he's you know, fallen into anonymity. As it were.
So yeah, the moral here is maybe a little more separation from the new Preakness, new Pimlico infield and the track.
Yep.
That might be one of the lessons from the Preakness. But you know, it is one of those unique things in racing, and you know, and we have like fewer and fewer of these where it's the place to be, you know, even if it's the place to go get schwasted and make an ass of yourself, it's the place to be at a racetrack in America. And we have fewer and fewer of those. Yeah. So I hope that with the new Pimlico, you know, there is a little bit more better security, better infrastructure, but I hope they don't get rid of the party atmosphere that they do have at the Preakness, because it is one of a kind, and you know, we're looking forward to it on Saturday. Rail Talk is sponsored by Facing Tipton. Facing Tipton's May digital sale closed early Tuesday evening with 75 horses sold for $3.25 million. Catalog had 2-year-olds, horses of racing age, breeding stock, yearlings, everything you could want to add to your stable. And Forbidden Kingdom, who was offered as a racing/stallion prospect, sold for $310,000 to our old friends at Legacy Ranch from the consignment of our new friends. Well, always friends, but our friends for this show, Taylor Made Sales Agency, agent for My Racehorse and Spendthrift Farm. If you remember, Forbidden Kingdom was the son of American Pharaoh, who won the San Vicente, the San Felipe. He was on a Derby trail. He was second in the Malibu. He won a Grade 2 on turf. So that's a pretty good price. Overall, I think that there's a lot of buyers getting what fits their program at the right prices and being able to turn those horses around and race them quickly. We saw it. We saw it with Mensa, obviously, for Resolute Racing being able to turn around and race on Derby week, which I often refuse to say. But another successful digital sale, and Facebook is going to keep pumping those digital sales out month by month, and they just keep getting bigger and better. But not to be outdone, next Monday and Tuesday, we're right around the corner from the Facebook Tipton in May. Mid-Atlantic. Like I said, digital sales on the brain. The Mid-Atlantic 2-year-olds in training sale, which is next Monday and Tuesday, May 20th and 21st at Timonium in Maryland, just after the Preakness. West Point's going to be down there shopping for sure, as I'm sure a bunch of other high-class buyers are. There's going to be some fireworks. They've been working this week on the dirt. I believe they had to cancel the Breeze show today because of the rain, but they'll get that wrapped up. And I'm sure there's a ton of great horse flesh who we'll be seeing winning some big stakes this summer, this fall, and beyond into the future at the Facig Mid-Atlantic May sale next week. Thrilled to bring this next guest to the Rail Talk studio, one of my favorite handicappers in the business. He's a handicapper for the Daily Racing Forum and Time Forum US, does the morning lines for Naira Tracks, and he's a Time Forum US podcast host, David Aragona. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Had a great conversation with you on your last podcast, Joe, so happy to come on with you and John and talk some horse racing.
Yeah, man, let's do it. So let's get right into the Derby. You know, this is well, you're the perfect person to ask this question too, because you know, you do work for Time Forum, and that takes pace into account with your figures. I thought it was an interesting dichotomy, the trip that Mystic Dan got and the trip that Sierra Leone and Forever Young got. Obviously, those two covered a lot more ground than Mystic Dan. The Mystic Dan was closer to the pace than they were. How do you go about analyzing that race? Can you separate the three at all, or just how do you feel about those top three?
Yeah, something I've talked about quite a bit with Craig Mulkowski, who makes our Timeform US speed figures, because obviously if those numbers take the pace of the race into account, we haven't yet gotten to the point where we feel confident taking ground loss into account, because we need a reliable metric more than just a human's eyes watching races to do that. But as far as the pace goes, I do think that the narrative that Mystic Dan was a lucky Kentucky Derby winner doesn't fully capture his performance, because he was much closer to that fast pace that did fall apart than horses like Sierra Leone, Forever Young, really the second through fifth place finishers. They all were no better than 13th in the early going of that race. I think Catching Freedom was the one that was closest to the pace, and he was still several lengths behind Mystic Dan moving down the backstretch. So I think when you take into account the ground loss for the second and third place finishers, as well as the pace that Mystic Dam was relatively close to, I wouldn't say it's necessarily clear cut that one ran so much better than the other two. I think Mystic Dam was a legitimate Kentucky Derby winner. The big question is, can he run as well coming back in 2 weeks?
And he's not the only one that's coming back after 2 weeks. You have Catching Freedom also, coming into the Preakness. Obviously, there's a bombshell change with Muth scratching out of the race. How does that change your handicapping, and what kind of impact does that have on who you think is going to win?
I was respecting Muth's chances to win the race before the scratch, though viewing him as a horse that was getting a little bit overrated coming into the race. I think there was this idea that he was just going to come in and clean up as the fresh horse and just taking the form lines from the Arkansas Derby. He had beaten Mystic Dad, he had beaten Just Steel, and might have been one of the favorites of the Kentucky Derby. So now he's just going to defeat these horses after there was a mild upset in the Kentucky Derby. I personally wasn't thrilled with Muth's races this year. I mean, it doesn't really matter at this point because he's out of the race. So for me, it takes some value out of the race not having him in there, because I did think he was going to be a shorter price than he really should have been. It also takes some pace out of the race. I didn't believe that the two Bob Bafferts were going to go head-to-head on the front end and create some sort of fast pace, but now it does kind of put this stablemate imagination in the driver's seat from a pace standpoint. I guess we'll see what the two Dwayne Lucas trainees do in terms of pressing that horse, but it probably puts a couple of the horses trying to come from off the pace at a bit of a disadvantage. At the end of the day, though, it's a mile and 3/16. These horses have to get the distance. I'm not going to make it all about the pace. So I still think it's a fairly wide open race.
You know, just to go back to the Derby for a second, you know, every year it's obvious when the first three, four finishers across the line, it's obvious that they ran well and ran good races and are horses to watch. Not to steal your catch tag there going forward. But I think a lot of times there are horses that have run like eighth or ninth and are just have like buried tough trips. Is there anybody that sticks out from the Derby beyond the top four finishers who you think ran well either against the grain of the race or covered more ground or had traffic trouble? Who do you look at beyond those top four?
You know, there aren't too many horses that I felt like were going to win the race if they had gotten a better trips. I mean, the first four finishers were well ahead of the rest, and it's hard to view that a trip really would have changed that result as far as the superfecta goes. I mean, obviously, T.O. Password, who was fifth, I thought he ran an admirable race considering how inexperienced he was coming into the race and the kind of trip that he got, which was totally unfamiliar to him. I don't think that really is going to be applicable to handicapping the upcoming races in this country, because he's probably not going to come back before the Breeders' Cup, if that. Beyond him, though, I thought Resilience ran pretty well. He made an early move to attack the pace at the top of the stretch, and obviously that pace did fall apart. He wasn't on top of the leaders early in the race, but he did move a little sooner than maybe you wanted to. And then after that, I don't know if there were too many horses that I feel like were cost a chance to be successful by the trips. I mean, going further back in the finishing order, I mean, I think Just the Touch was the last one across the wire, but he really lost all chance at the start, just got banged around. And I think he was 10th in the early going. That was never going to be a trip that was successful for that horse. I have no idea where we'll see him again, but the Derby is just the kind of race that I would draw a line through for a horse like him.
Right. Right. And David, you have a really good line on the history of racing. I've read a lot of your analysis and you go through meticulously about, what our business has changed over the years and how it's grown. What are your feelings about A, having the Belmont at Saratoga this year, and B, the discussion that the industry is having right now about possibly changing the timing of the Triple Crown races?
I mean, I think that having the Belmont at Saratoga is an interesting novelty. I mean, I don't really know if it's going to have long-lasting effects on the Triple Crown. As far as the immediate effects this year, I think it makes the Belmont Stakes a lot more appealing for some of the horses coming out of the Kentucky Derby, especially a horse that, you know, gets that mile and a quarter distance to just wait for the Belmont Stakes, even though it's likely to come up a deeper field than the Preakness. I know that having timing that fits certain trainers' patterns often outweighs the reward that comes with winning a classic race like the Preakness. So we often see that with the Preakness Stakes. I mean, I think one of the things that keeps the Triple Crown in balance is the mile and a half distance of the Belmont Stakes, because it makes the Preakness a better option for some of those horses that you don't think are going to really relish that marathon trip. So it creates incentive to run back in 2 weeks when that's not the inclination of a lot of modern trainers these days. So having the Belmont Stakes at a mile and a quarter for a couple of years, it's interesting. I'll be very intrigued to see how it all plays out over this year, next. We'll see however long this lasts for. But I mean, when the Belmont Stakes does return to Belmont Park, obviously it's going to return to a mile and a half. I mean, I don't think that they're looking to start the Belmont Stakes on the turn to, for a mile and a quarter in the future. I know some people are concerned that the Triple Crown is going to change forever because it's been in Saratoga for a couple of years. I think it's going to restore some of that balance to the Triple Crown. So I want to get away from drawing any conclusions about what to do with the Triple Crown based on examples of 2024 and 2025, because they're just going to be different years, a different set of circumstances than surrounding years. As far as what was happening leading up to this year, yeah, the Preakness hasn't been coming up as strong a race as the Kentucky Derby, certainly not. And maybe it's a slightly weaker race than the Belmont, but I think we've been trending that way for a long time. Mm-hmm. Trainers have not wanted to run back in 2 weeks now for a good couple of decades. And rare is the Preakness Stakes that we see everybody for the Kentucky Derby come back. I mean, I could think of a few years going back to when I first got into racing, like 1997, when Silver Charm and Captain Bodger and Freehouse, they all came back and ran in every leg of the series. But that's pretty rare. I mean, even after that, immediately after that, we see the Preakness kind of lull a bit in terms of the quality. So I was toying with the idea of advocating for changing the dates last year, but it looked like the Preakness was coming up, you know, considerably weaker than some prior years. But the more I think about it, and now entering into these couple of years where we're not going to have great examples, I just kind of want to see how things play out. I'm not somebody who's going to advocate for significantly changing the Triple Crown, at least based on the evidence that we're taking in at the moment.
Very measured. That's how I've always known you to be. And I appreciate that. There's a lot of fly off the handle, not enough fly off the handle people in racing. And I was thinking, I was mentioning this before, the 07 Preakness was one of my favorite of all time. Mm-hmm. When Curlin and Street Sense and Hardspun all came back in that initial and in that running of the middle jewel. You made a comment earlier today on Twitter that I noticed about the graded stakes committee, because Andy Serling was advocating for the Kentucky Derby being the first grade one of the year for three-year-olds, which I'm open-minded to. But we broadened that out to talk about earlier this year about all the races in New York being downgraded and pretty much none in Kentucky. Not pretty much, none. Yeah. No races being downgraded in Kentucky. Do you think that there's like something to be done here in terms of reforming the graded stakes evaluation process? Like, if you had your druthers, what are some of the changes you would make?
If I had my druthers, the American Graded Stakes Committee would be made up of horse players and not people in the breeding industry. To me, that's a no-brainer. But I mean, as far as the graded stakes go, I mean, if you look at examples of other countries where Triple Crowns really work, there are a lot fewer grade one races because the top horses in the division have to wait and run in those top races to get the syndications, the breeding deals, I mean, to make their value increase. And one of the unfortunate things about the Preakness Stakes is that it's not appealing to run back in 2 weeks, and you might be able to attain the same breeding value for your colt by just waiting for a race like the Haskell or the Pennsylvania Derby, because they're both grade ones. And based on some of the stud fees that we've seen coming out, they matter just as much to the people breeding to those stallions as the Preakness. So I think that the Triple Crown, some of that luster could be restored if we took a hard look at the entire calendar of graded stakes races and made some difficult decisions about what really is a championship level race. Are all of the grade one races really on the level of the Kentucky Derby, the Breeders' Cup? They're not, obviously. And there are some questionable decisions to upgrade races, questionable decisions to maybe grant a certain level of leeway or charity to certain circuits that maybe have had races, a bunch of races at the grade one level that are lacking in quality over several years now. So I think a lot of work could be done, and the American Graded Stakes Committee has a lot of power to create some significant changes to create better sport in terms of the racing. I'm just disappointed that they never seem willing to do it, and they just kind of move the pieces around the board and, you know, grant different circuits couple more grade one races, remove a few, but nothing significant really changes. So I don't want to take credit for this idea, because I feel like I read a Blood Horse article where somebody else advocated for this position, but I thought it was a really good idea to, if you don't want to downgrade all these races, create a new class above grade one, something like, you know, a C level race for like championship or mm-hmm. or classic that is just for the Triple Crown, the Breeders' Cup, maybe the Travers, or, you know, another, you know, race on that level. And I think that would restore some sense of prestige to those major races that really do deserve it.
Right. No, that's an excellent point. David, aside from the obvious, the Triple Crown races, the big races of Saratoga, the Breeders' Cup, what's a race that historically comes up on your calendar where you're like, oh, goody, I can't wait to see who are the entries in this race?
Oh, that's a good question. It doesn't necessarily have to be grade one races. I mean, there are a lot of turf stakes races that come up, especially during the summer at Saratoga, that I look forward to every year. I think it's questionable whether they should be grade one races, but I find the Turf Triple Series in New York to be really interesting to handicap. But also, I just look forward to the undercard stakes races on a lot of those major racing days. Kentucky Derby Day, that was a really fun, difficult, but fun card to handicap a couple of weeks ago. Belmont Stakes Day, the same sort of thing. I just like full fields where there's a lot to dig into from a handicapping standpoint, where I can make observations that maybe everybody else isn't making. You don't get that as much with the 4 and 5 horse fields. So I like to look for those situations where there's just a lot of content to sift through.
What is your sense of the new Belmont Park? Because you're a New York guy, a dyed-in-the-wool New York handicapper. Obviously, Belmont has a ton of tradition. It hurts my heart, honestly, to go walk to the Belmont Barns and walk past it just being a giant construction site, especially because we didn't really get to say goodbye because they said there was going to be another meet this year. And then we're like, actually, psych. The renderings I wasn't a huge fan of. What's your take in terms of what you've seen so far from the new Belmont?
Yeah, I mean, I understand that there are a lot of emotions around this because, like me, people have been going to Belmont Park, for all their lives of following New York racing, and you have such attachment to that building, even though you kind of know that it's outdated and the entire facility hasn't been in use for a long time, really aside from just on Belmont Stakes Day, and it didn't make a whole lot of financial sense. You still are attached to it. I mean, the walls with the ivy in the backyard and the tree in the paddock. I mean, it was just a fun place to visit. And I think that sense of nostalgia gets lost a little bit when you see the renderings of a Belmont Park that looks completely different from what you're familiar with. I will say, though, change is hard at first, but in the long run, it often pans out to be a net positive. And I think this was a facility that did need updating. And I don't want to draw too many conclusions from a series of renderings. I want to see how it all comes together and plays out. I haven't been to some of the more modern racetracks around the world. I know some people have compared it to certain racetracks in Europe that have been made over in recent years, and there have been mixed reactions to those. I'm just interested to see how it looks. I mean, I have some of my takeaways from the renderings are that it looks like there are some open air parts, that there's a lot of visibility and light. I think that's all. Those are all positives for Belmont Park. A lot of area to see the horses. I think that's going to be a positive. So I don't want to get ahead of myself and saying that I love it or hate it. I'm just interested to see how it all plays out. But I also understand that there are a lot of those emotions that people are sad to see it go, and that they feel regretful that they didn't get to say that goodbye to the facility. I think that is unfortunate the way that all played out. I understand why it played out that way, but it's still unfortunate that the fans didn't get that.
David, we understand that the reason why they have that open air areas is because that's supposed to be the grassy areas, which I thought meant that you'd be able to like get a picnic there. But no, they mean that that's where you can roll and smoke.
Okay. Well, that's the entirety of Aqueduct. So we already got a track.
Yeah.
that's full service in terms of
that's forward thinking by Belmont. Yes.
Yeah, no doubt. I think to me, it's mainly just that it doesn't resemble the old Belmont in any meaningful way. Like, that to me is the biggest issue. And it's like, oh, there's a lot of tradition that you're kind of throwing out the window. I better not get rid of that tree. Otherwise, I'm going up there to cut somebody. But last question for me. I'm getting very emotional here. Last question for me, David. It's a handicapping question, more of a general one. You know, every handicapper's got an opinion on the Derby and these big races. And like, you know, I think that, you know, those races are kind of over handicapped to a certain point. One of the things I respect about you is, like, I feel like you are very good at unearthing prices in the cheaper races and the claimers and the maiden claimers. Is there anything in particular that you look for in those kind of races? Like, I'll just give you an example. Like, for a claiming race, if I see a horse going to a new barn and they're working quickly and they had never worked quickly before, like, I don't pay that much attention to the work tab, but if it's aberrant from the previous works, that'll be something that I'll sit up and take notice no matter what the morning line is. What are some of the things that you do to unearth prices in these cheaper races?
I mean, I feel like I use the same methods at every level to try to unearth horses that are going to be value. I do a lot of trip handicapping, and I could argue it matters more the lower level races, because something can go wrong for maybe a cheaper horse and it's going to really impact the result, whereas maybe a horse of more quality could encounter some adversity during the race and be able to overcome it. So I think when you're handicapping some of those maiden races or lower level claiming races, you want to grant more leeway to horses to maybe throw in a poor effort from time to time if you can see some sort of reason. For instance, if a horse gets slammed coming out of the starting gate and they're a speed horse and they can't get to the front end and they end up finishing seventh by 20 lengths, maybe you have to be forgiving of that, where if that were a stakes horse, you'd view that as a real negative. And sometimes those horses, those performances where horses really do show a poor result, handicappers will not go back and watch the replay and try to find the excuse, and they'll just sort of disregard the horse. So I think those are the situations where you can find prices. Often, you know, horses making changes are something that I'll look for. And that comes down to following a circuit really closely, to knowing the patterns of a lot of the trainers, not just the top level trainers that have the majority of starters, but some of the trainers that maybe run only, you know, one or two horses a week, and knowing what their patterns are, what they usually do, where they spot their horses. I think that can really help handicapping some of those races at the lower levels.
And David, since you go so in depth on the past performances, was there ever a time where you were like, this would be a good claim, I'd like to claim this horse? And if so, who would you give the horse to?
The thoughts have crossed my mind. You know, it's funny, when I'm writing analysis for a lot of races, you see some horses sell at auction for huge prices, or, you know, be privately purchased. And sometimes you'll hear, you know, whispers about what a horse sold for. And I think to myself, doesn't make sense to buy the horse then, because that's when the value is at the peak. You want to buy them before their value peaks. And, you know, sometimes I think about that, like, oh, I feel like this horse is sitting on some improvement or a better performance, and, you know, I want to wait for the horse to get to the right spot. But, you know, if I was an owner, maybe I'd want to get involved at this point in time. Right. So, yeah, you know, it's not something I spent a whole lot of time thinking about, because I really haven't, you know, ever gotten involved in that side of the game, or, you know, really, you know, endeavored to do so. It is an interesting thought exercise.
Good. Okay. We'll talk off air. We'll see if you want to grab a 10% or
John,
like that.
Stop pretending like you claim horses, John.
Well, listen, if David picked one out, that'd be a different story. You know, I mean,
that's honestly a good idea. We'll have to put our heads together. David, thank you so much for coming on with us. Horse to Watch is how you follow David on Twitter/X. And it's a very, very worthwhile follow. Appreciate the insight, man. Keep up the great work.
Thanks for having me.
Rail Talk is sponsored by TaylorMade. TaylorMade consigned the topper of the Facing Tipton May digital sale in Forbidden Kingdom, but they also consigned six horses, I believe, for John Green and DJ Stable at that same sale. John, why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Joe, the nice thing about it is that we use TaylorMade as our consigners for all of our sales, whether it's yearling, weanling, broodmare prospect, broodmare herself. You know, they span the scope of all the major sales. And now we've been using them exclusively for the online digital sales as well. And like you mentioned, we had six horses entered. We had a broodmare in foal, the Street Sense Baby Seal, that sold for $80,000, one of the close to the sales toppers. And then we also had a gaggle of racehorses that we sold also. And all in all, Joe, they sold five out of six of our horses. And the thing that was really cool is I was on the phone with Jeff Hazlett, who's the sales manager at TaylorMade and manages our portfolio. And after our horse Swift Delivery sold for $55,000, hip 63 in the sale, number one in your heart, he was like, hey, you know, we have some action on the last horse that you're selling with us, Hallen, but he's not quite bringing the same amount that we thought we would. You know, we thought that Swift Delivery and Hallen would bring about the same amount. So quick thinking on Jeff's part, He knew who the underbidder was on Swift Delivery, because it's a TaylorMade client, called that guy and said, hey, you know, you like Swift Delivery because he was a, you know, he had conditions and he was a state bred and he had all the things in front of him. Hallen's exact same thing. And he's already in Florida and he's a Florida bred. And sure enough, the guy ended up buying the horse for a very reasonable price, I think, for $28,000, but got the horse sold for us just because of that phone call and because of that quick thinking. Is probably more important. So it's not just a matter of they put the nice pictures up, they put the fun video up, they put a couple of salesy, you know, bites. Everyone can do that. It's TaylorMade taking the extra step, making the extra call, putting out, you know, the extra email or text on a Sunday afternoon before the sale to try to get that horse You know, in a new home. And it's, again, it's value. He, Jeff could call the guy and in good conscience say, this is a value play for you. You know, DJ wants to have, you know, stake horses. He's just a cut below that, but he's ready made. He's a turnkey horse and he's ready to go. He vets well. And it was because of that extra effort that got the horse sold. And their other client has a new horse, turnkey horse, that they can run literally this week.
Love to see that. Love to see that happy marriage of seller and buyer, facilitated by the great people at TaylorMade, and with them, your family. Find out more at TaylorMadeFarm.com. All right, so we teased this in the open, but DJ Stable had a very impressive winner over the weekend at Gulfstream Park. And color me shocked, they race at Gulfstream Park after Florida Derby Day? Just kidding. We all know they have a great year-round program there. And Bullet was a first-time starter, winner in a juvenile filly stake race on the grass, and may be Royal Ascot bound. But John, why don't you tell us what the plans are?
Well, Joey, first of all, I thank you for bringing it up, because we've always felt like Bullet was an impressive filly. She's a war front. You know, she's a daughter of Marlon Spike, who's a Tappet, and the second and third dam were both champions. So, you know, she's pretty well bred, and we spent a lot of money on her. We spent $425,000, which is a lot of money for an animal. And she's always been like near the top of the group, and it was just a matter of where were we going to run her and to what capacity. We talked to Mark Cassie about it. We decided to run her, you know, try her first time out in the Royal Palm. And our thought was, and the reason why we named her Bullet, quite frankly, was because she was really fast out of the gate. So of course, what does she do? She breaks flat footed and is in last place in a five furling race where the track has, you know, for the most part all season been lightning fast and speed favoring. Needless to say, she came out and, you know, saved room on the rail. Jaramillo did a great job of getting her, you know, kind of slingshot around the top of the stretch around horses, and she kept going and won impressively, which, you know, when the race is over, you're very excited because now she's a stake winner and has a really nice pedigree. So that's nice for valuation down the road. But Joe, it also gave us a very unique opportunity because the relationship that Gulfstream has with Royal Ascot on this race is, it's kind of a win and you're in. If you win, you have free passage to go there. I say free, they give you $25,000 travel allowance, which is good. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not like they give you a check for 25 grand, but they give you a travel credit for $25,000.
What do you want? $25,000 Amazon gift card? Yeah, they're paying for you to go.
Yeah, I want it against my American Express card.
Okay.
And they give you, because she's a filly, they give you one of six races that you can choose from to run in. I will tell you, for the first time ever, this is the official word, is that after running the math and doing our due diligence and trying to figure out how to get the horse there, how to get us there, how to get, the trainer there, Mark Cassie, and his assistant. And there's a lot of logistics because it's not like you can ship into the racetrack like you can here. You have to go to a training yard, and get approval beforehand. Before that, you have to go through quarantine. Before that, you have to get on a plane. Like there's a lot of things that go into it. And in combination with the risk reward analysis that we did, we are deciding to bypass running her at Royal Ascot, and instead are going to run her in a couple of the races up in Canada on the turf, with the hopes that she can stretch out to a mile, run in the Natalma. Ironically enough, on your wedding day.
Help me God, bro.
And then do well enough where she can run at Del Mar in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Filly turf race. So that's the decision we made. It's a difficult decision. We appreciate Royal Ascot and Gulfstream for offering and making those conditions available to us. But in the best interest of the horse, we've decided that we are going to take our talents north of the border.
I mean, you say that's the reason. I honestly think the reason is because you couldn't find a top hat to fit that big dome, could you?
There's no question about it. And my ass is matching as far as getting bigger and bigger, and the tails don't look good when you have a big booty. So that wasn't going to work either. But yeah, you know, a lot went into it. I mean, it's not an easy decision because you really have to look at it and say, if it's strictly financial, it's one decision. If it's, hey, this is a bucket list item that I want to achieve and fulfill and be a part of, then it may be a different answer. But for us at this time, we just decided it was best for the horse, quite frankly, to give her a few weeks now, send her up to Canada, run in July, run in August, hopefully run in September, and then hopefully run in the Breeders' Cup. But we are going to have to talk about changing your wedding day, or at least moving the venue. Would you do it up at Woodbine if we wanted to?
I don't know if most of my friends are allowed to cross the border, but
can we have a TV in the corner at least? I'm sure there's gonna be a simulcast TV.
I'm sure you'll wedding. Be streaming during the ceremony. Like that's already a given.
Okay. That's in your vows, isn't it? To have and to hold in exactas or trifectas or carryovers.
Exactly.
Carryover pools. No?
Meg, you are the rising star of my heart.
I can't even.
Real talk exclusive there.
Oh, can't wait, man. Can't wait. For Bullet and the wedding.
And the wedding. Yeah. In that order. That's not necessarily right.
All right, so that's going to do it for episode 44 of Rail Talk. Thank you to David Aragona for coming by and talking some Triple Crown with us. Thank you to John Green. Thank you to our producer, Patty Wolf. Our associate producers, Nathan Wilkinson and Julia Agresta. Thanks to the sponsors. And thanks to you for tuning in. Enjoy the Preakness at Old Hilltop. We'll see you next week back here on Rail Talk.